Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host, Matt Watson. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Jason Taylor, somebody I used to work with at Stackify. We're going to talk today about his company, Matchless Cabinet. He's the founder and CEO. You know, he went from being CTO at Stackify to a cabinet maker with the Amish. We're going to learn about it today. It's going to be a fun conversation. And he's got a seven-figure side hustle going. We're going to learn all about his side hustle, and hopefully will inspire some of you to have your own side hustle. Do want to take a second to remind everybody, today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale, which is my company. We have 300 employees working for dozens of companies, startups, scale-ups, building all sorts of technology. If you need to hire software developers, check us out at fullscale.io. Jason, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks, Matt. It's been a while. I'm glad to be on, finally. You know, how many episodes have you done?
There's like 1,200 something. I don't know, a lot.
1,200. And this is the first time you're having me on.
Well, you got to listen to a bunch of them in the office.
I got to listen to a whole lot in the office.
Yeah, because so back to the Stackify days when we started this podcast like 6 years ago. Yeah, we were in the Stackify office and you saw all the guests come in and out and all that stuff every day. And so,
yeah, putting the sound booth up in the spare office.
And yeah, you probably helped with some of that at some point in time. Well, so tell me, how did you go from CTO at Stackify, and then you left and you worked at Microsoft for a while, doing all sorts of very high-tech stuff, to now building cabinets?
With an Amish business partner. Isn't that how everyone does it? Yeah, because when you think high-tech and cloud and Microsoft and the FANG companies, you're thinking Amish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's been an interesting journey to get here, and you know, I've always been looking for something that can really be mine. You know, Stackify was probably the closest I'd ever been to that. Previously, I came in early after you started the company, and you know, there was a lot of my DNA in there. But you know, that was your company, that was your baby, and so. You know, working in high tech and then working in sales, I mean, it's a great gig. You have years that are great. You have years that aren't so great. You have times that you're busy. You have times that you're slow. But I've always just kind of wondered, you know, what's going to come along? What's going to be my side hustle? Am I going to be, you know, day trading, you know, coins somewhere, or you know, what am I going to do? And but as a lot of these things go, I think it's generally born out of some sort of passion you have or a hobby that you have. And you know this about me from all the years we've known each other. I've always been kind of a home remodeler and do-it-yourself sort of guy, right?
Yeah.
And but I never really wanted to do anything in that space. Like I just never thought like that's going to be viable. And so about August or so of 2019. Wait, what year are we in? I'm trying to
think. Before COVID?
COVID messed with everything, right? No, it was actually during COVID. So okay. That summer, I had built a new deck on the back of our house. And it was great. We had a bunch more room. It looked nice. And for 15 years, I've been a fan of the Big Green Egg. You know, if you're familiar with that, like the big ceramic cooker everybody has, and have had one for years. And I had it in this little cart that, you know, didn't have quite enough storage, didn't have quite enough, you know, prep space on it. And now we had this big, beautiful new deck. And I thought, well, you know, I want to do something different. And I knew of a couple companies out there that were making carts and tables and stands for these things. And, you know, there's kind of a big aftermarket space for, you know, accessories for all of these grills. And so I was looking around at that, and I'd seen some of them before. I'd built a wooden one prior, a tree fell on it. So, and after the tree fell on it, I was like, I don't want to build one again. And so I was looking at some options that were made, you know, all from metal, and you could kind of pick from a few colors, and man, they were expensive. They were like $4,000. And I was like, yeah, you know, there's got to be something else out there, you know, and something I can go a little bit larger in scale and maybe build more of an outdoor kitchen. And I found a couple options on the market, and those manufacturers operated in a very traditional sense of, you know, going through a dealer installer network, and you'd have to find your local rep and call them and have them come out to your house and measure and do all this stuff. And then they come back and they give you a quote. You're thinking, okay, this is going to cost $7,000 or $8,000. And they give you a quote for $70,000 or $80,000. And you go,
good Lord,
this is just crazy. And you know, you could go the traditional route of kind of frame it and then do stone veneer and, you know, stucco and things like that. And I didn't love the look of that. So I just kept digging. I said, somebody has to be manufacturing a product like this. And in the back of my mind, what I thought is I went back to the days when, you know, I lived in Prairie Village and had this little house that we bought, and we needed to put in a new kitchen. And IKEA had planning software that if you were, you know, reasonably competent and you could work a tape measure, you could figure out your cabinet plan, and here's what it costs. Right. And then you just click buy, and you go drive to IKEA, and you load it in the truck, and then you come home and assemble for 3 weeks, right?
You bring home a truck full of Legos.
Yeah, you bring home a truck full of Legos. And I thought, you know, that's what this buying experience should be. And so I keep searching, and I come across this manufacturer that had, you know, prefabricated carts, and they had cabinetry. And I had never, ever, ever heard of them. So, you know, I sent out a couple emails, and they got back to me, and the guy said, well, why don't you give me a call? And I talked to him, and he said, well, you know, we're still kind of new to this, and we don't have any dealers in your area, but I'd be willing to sell directly to you. And he sent me his price sheet, and I said, well, that's actually really reasonable prices. That's a lot better than some of the competitors I've been seeing. And then his words of, I don't have any dealers in your area, just stuck in my brain.
Yeah.
And in the course of about 2 hours, I decided this could be a nice, tidy little side hustle. Like, I could sell a bunch of cabinetry to people, you know, around town here and in my neighborhood, and, you know, South Overland Park, all these people are building nice, fancy homes, and, you know, people are out in their garages.
In the Kansas City area.
Yeah. And all of that. So I thought this will be a nice little thing. Maybe I can, you know, I can buy my stuff at a lower price and then I can make some money off of it. So in the course of a couple hours, I went from being this semi-casual shopper. And the funny thing about that, Matt, is
owning a cabinet company.
Yeah. And so here's the mental gymnastics that happened. And you'll get a kick out of this because you know my wife. I was doing all of this searching without having spoken to her about it. And so, you know, it's not in the budget, Matt. It's not on the spreadsheet. So I'm going, how am I going to justify this? I know. I'll become a dealer. And then
you gotta sell three cabinets
lower,
first.
Yeah, then I'm getting it at a lower cost. And she'll be like, oh, okay. So literally that morning, I'd been on the phone with this guy who had this kind of thick Pennsylvania Dutch accent. telling me about his cabinets to Lindsay comes home and I go, hey, I think I just started a company.
Good morning.
Yeah. And then the journey started. And it was really interesting because almost instantly I was able to put together in my mind like all the different pieces to this business model and how we could go disrupt the market because once I saw how the product was manufactured and how the catalog was built, that idea I had of the kind of IKEA self-service model, selling directly to customers and allowing them to build and select online, I saw a path to that happening and that nobody else in the market was doing it because I searched for weeks for it. And
So obviously people must do this for indoor cabinets, or you go, well, even then maybe you still primarily go to a custom cabinet maker and they have their own software that they use to do this. Probably a lot of consumers don't do this themselves, is my guess online. But an outdoor kitchen is a lot simpler too, right? It's you know, 6 feet long, or it's a simple L shape or whatever. Like, it's probably a lot simpler for a consumer to do an outdoor kitchen.
Yeah, you generally speaking don't have the constraints of I have a wall here and some other obstacle to go around and I've already got plumbing coming through somewhere. Now, we do get into more advanced builds where we have that. But even to your point, even in the indoor market, there's not a whole lot of self-service cabinetry out there. So, and that was a challenge of trying to find the model of how do we go out and tackle this? How do we do this? How do I build software that can do this? And I think that's been a huge part of it, you know, in our journey so far, is I'm thinking about this through the lens of a big background of software development and realizing
so you had to build a lot.
We had to build a lot. Yeah.
So what does the tech stack of that look like? Is this like a WebGL sort of like in the browser 3D rendering? How do you build that?
So our kind of end-to-end stack is a number of things that have been put together. Like any kind of distributed system is at scale is we've got our store front end, which is, you know, commercially available SaaS product storefront. And then we've got a lot of integration that we've had to build. Now we tried to go everything out of the box as much as we could early on. I didn't want to be in the software development business, but inevitably we ended up there. But our planning software is, to your point, kind of a WebGL JavaScript browser-based front end.
Okay. And had to build.
We had some help. I did find a company that had a product that could be used as a base that they would customize and host for you. So it's a SaaS product that's heavily customized to your catalog and your business needs. And I've had a pretty heavy hand in that as well. But there was a little bit of a journey to get to that. And that was one thing as a, you know, technologist that I got to do for the first time was really understand the 3D modeling space, which is really interesting. I mean, it was so far from anything that I've ever worked on. And believe it or not, my Amish business partners work and design in 3D CAD tools. In the years that I was at Microsoft, I served a lot of the architectural, engineering, and construction community for sales. And they all used this piece of software called SolidWorks. And it's a 3D modeling tool that has materials awareness. So it knows if you're, you know, building this model with you know, wood or metal or whatever, or plastic, you know, these are the properties of all of it. And it understands machining. You can say, I'm going to take this piece of metal, I'm going to bend it. And it knows it's not going to be a perfect 90 degrees. There's going to be a little radius in that bend and kind of all those little factors. And so there are these super, super rich, you know, billions of polygons making up these models that give you perfect renderings that are photorealistic and can be used to do very, very detailed plans. But that doesn't translate to web very well, right? Okay. So we went through a few different iterations where early on we took that and we kind of rebuilt into an AutoCAD and Google SketchUp or I guess it's not Google anymore. It's Trimble that owns SketchUp now, and you know, built it into a model there. And as I was working with customers, I'd have to crack open AutoCAD, and then I'd go put a plan together, and then I'd send it to them. And that worked for a while, but that doesn't scale very rapidly.
Yeah.
I can't be doing all of these. I needed a way for customers to be able to go do it on their own. And how do you do that? It's got to be an app on their phone, or it's got to be browser-based. They aren't going to get anything more complicated than that.
And so since then, you have built all that, right? Like, you have this whole end-to-end sort of e-commerce experience for that.
Yeah, we've built all of that, and that includes kind of the integration points to go between the storefront to our planning software, and then back to the storefront to complete checkout. And you know, some of the other concerns that are in there as well. There's this isn't dropping a T-shirt in a box and sending via UPS.
Or yeah, FedEx. Yeah.
You've got
shipping's a problem.
Full of cabinets. Yeah. So everything has to go by LTL freight, and that was one of the next obstacles I ran into is how do you calculate that in real time so that, you know, you can get somebody to check out and convert. The last thing you want is for somebody to put $8,000 of cabinets in their shopping cart, but then they got to contact you to check out.
Well, and then they get a surprise that it's actually $2,000 more to ship this to you.
Yeah, which in some cases it is, but
yeah.
You know, you want to know that up front and allow this to be a pretty self-service process. So I had to find the right freight broker to work with that had, you know, the level of service that I needed and the rates that I needed and the software APIs that I needed to be able to go out and real-time calculate quotes.
So far you sound like the typical software developer. I found a problem. I spent a whole bunch of time solving it all with technology, right? But
a lot of customer service.
So tell me though, from a business perspective, how did you figure out how to scale the sales part of this, right? Because that's really the other part of this that makes it successful, right? Like, you built the technology, but you've also figured out how to scale the sales part of it. So how did you figure out how to do the sales part of it as well?
So they really go hand in hand, I think. My vision and my hypothesis that we got to test early on was that this could be a fairly self-service product, that we could get people 80% of the way, maybe a little bit more. Ideally, get people to go end to end. They build their plan, they drop it in the shopping cart, they check out, and they're done. But you know, worst case scenario, I wanted to be able to get people to 80% of the way there, where they understand the product, they understand what they need, and you just help them with a few fine-grained details, answer a couple questions, and build confidence in, like, yeah, I'm buying the right thing, and it's a quality product, and I'm going to love it. And so the first step was really building that technology platform, seeing how people would use it, and seeing what our conversion rate was for people actually putting it in their shopping cart, right? That was a big indicator of like somebody's bought into this. They aren't afraid of doing it. And then it's been just a matter of if you can do that really well, if you can take care of 80% of that up front with a complex product like this, then the rest of it can go pretty quickly. You know, you'll get an email that might have five questions. You know, I want to understand a size, a fit of something, you know, how does install work, a couple things like that. And you can, you know, as somebody even working on this part-time, you can handle 20 to 30 of those inquiries a day and then still be processing orders. So, you know, just the nature of it being technology-driven and a good customer experience for e-com takes care of a lot of that scale on its own.
So as you're sitting here chatting, I'm on your website designing cabinets. And what's cool is it's like one click to jump right in and go do it. Although it looks like I'm building the cabinets in a house, not outside.
Yeah. So we do have a new revision coming later this year that allows you to remove the walls from the box. So you can make it feel like you're outside and without walls.
So you said you did a lot of, you built it, did a lot of testing, figuring out, okay, do we get people to use this thing? Will they use it? Will they order online? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, what did you figure out for a sales channel though? Like, how did you figure out, you know, did you have certain business partners that are selling your custom cabinets, or how was the go-to-market strategy of actually driving revenue though?
Chance, luck, a little bit of gut. You know, really what I found is what led me to starting the company, I figured would be a good starting point. And that was, I wanted an outdoor kitchen because I had this particular grill and smoker that I really loved, which happens to have a cult following around it already. So I went in search of, where do these people congregate and talk? How do you earn their trust? Because these are, you know, rabid, loyal fans of a product. And if you can augment their experience in a way that they can also become rabid, loyal fans of, it's going to sell itself within that community. So, you know, there's a vast pool of Facebook groups for whatever okay. your interest is, right? And some of those, especially in like the outdoor cooking space and outdoor kitchens and barbecue and all that, some of these groups are enormous, you know, 100,000 plus members. They also really don't like you to go advertise there.
I'm sure.
You know, you have to find ways to kind of introduce your product organically. And it's always this cycle of you know, organically promoting your product and finding advocates and fans and customers and having them advocate on your behalf as well. Which as it turns out, my hunch there was right. You know, if you find one of these people who loves this space and you just, you know, overwhelm them with an experience that they couldn't get anywhere else and deliver them a fantastic product at a fantastic value, they're going to go sing your praises to everybody else in those channels. So that was one step. And then the other has just been through digital marketing. I mean, it's Google Ads and Microsoft Ads and Facebook Ads,
okay.
Instagram Ads. And that was another big challenge for me. That was a space I knew nothing about. And here I am stumbling my way through the Shopify platform, which has some tools to allow you to take your stuff and, you know, promote it on those channels. And it's like setting money on fire. I mean, I mean, it really is. Like, you know, you and I deal with this world of like very well-structured data. You know, all of us old developers, you know, started with like transactional databases, and everything had very clear-cut dimensions and values. And then you go and look at like all the metrics that come out of Google Ads and how they count conversions, but it's kind of this squishy data and it's not real time, and you're trying to tie it back to an actual purchase that happened. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. And so I had to find help for that. And that's a really interesting market because there are so many companies out there that you know, aim to improve your presence and get you a better return on ad spend.
I own one of them.
Yeah, and you own one of them. Yeah. And you know, and I don't know how you monetize this, but right away I found that it reminded me of like the old school like investment advisors. They don't care about your performance.
No, they don't.
They want you to deposit more money because they get paid 20, on deposits.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
They want 20% of your spend.
Yeah. So I worked, you know, I said, I've got to start somewhere. And so I found a firm that had, you know, good kind of certified partner status with both Google Ads and Microsoft Ads, reached out to them, and I kind of had to set up my budgets to say, okay, here's how much I'm willing to spend, and I'm really going to stick to that. Because, and sure enough, I mean, right away, it's like, oh, well, you know, you just need to spend more. And I'm going, okay, but if I'm going to be spending more, I also want to see our return on ad spend improving.
Yeah.
And I want to know in more detail what's working well, what's working not well. And ultimately so we did that for a while, and it helped get some things in order, helped me figure out what I really wanted. But then I said, I've got to have somebody who's has a little bit more vested interest in this, just improving all the time. So I basically went the staff aug route. I found a company that does staff aug for marketing, and it doesn't matter if it's, you know, it's digital marketing or content marketing or, you know, traditional marketing, they've got somebody, who can do that. And they're going to present you a bunch of resumes and put somebody on okay. you know, kind of contract terms with you. And, you know, found somebody who's fantastic. They were able to find me somebody who's worked in the e-com space with direct consumer brands. And, okay. and he's been able to make a tremendous difference.
So, well, and that, if you need to and hire, if you're looking for somebody for StaffHog for software development, definitely keep Full Scale in mind. That's what we do, right? So we build development teams for other people. We have 300 employees in the Philippines that do all sorts of dev work, QA, testing, all that kind of stuff. Check us out at fullscale.io. So tell, who else is part of your team? So tell us more about the team, because the other thing that's interesting about all this has always been your side hustle, right? And so you've always had a full-time job while building this big cabinet company now.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it has become big. I mean, we shipped to all 50 states in the US. We've been shipping to Canada and South America some. We've got a lot of demand to get overseas. That's a lot of headaches that I've got to figure out here in the next couple of years. And we're now taking on with our manufacturing partner full distribution rights. So we have exclusivity for all online retail for their products. And that's become our white label brand of Matchless. And then under their manufacturing brand, now we're going to be distributing for brick and mortar and managing that entire dealer network. So how am I doing that with it being a side hustle? So it's a number of things. You know, so we talked about like scaling the sales process and making that low touch, no touch. There's been other components of that as well. I mean, the accounting side of this is tremendous. For every order, I've got bookkeeping that I've got to do because I've got an order that goes to my manufacturer and payables there and the freight bills and all this. So we've tried to automate as much of the accounting as possible, automate as much of the logistics as possible. You know, fortunately, all these platforms have APIs. So we've integrated to QuickBooks, we've integrated to our freight provider, all of this. But at the end of the day, you do need help from people at a certain point. So we've got a couple people on the team now. So I started my first kind of hire was the contract hire for digital advertising. And, you know, that resource probably works about, 20, 30 hours a month. That's a nice thing too. Like he's a very, very efficient person and we know what we're doing really well now. So we've kind of set our campaigns. We measure the performance. He makes small adjustments where necessary. And when we need to do things seasonally or promotion wise, you know, we just kind of put those out there, manage them, pull them back in when we're done. On top of that, we are continuously trying to improve our experience. And while I can write a lot of software and a lot of integration, I don't make things pretty or usable. So I need some UX help.
And I can vouch for that.
Thank you. I've come a long way. I think I do better at it now. And so I've actually enlisted somebody you know as well, our old friend Mel Hogan. He's helped me with that quite a bit. And you know, it's great working with a designer that you've got, you know, previous working experience with. They can kind of understand how I think and how I describe things and turn it into a functional design. So Mel's been a great help there. And then I actually was able to turn one of my very first customers into a salesperson for us.
Oh,
so,
wow.
And it's so funny. It's kind of his side hustle too. He's actually a clinical surgery assistant. He's basically a doctor. He's got, you know, all the degrees and background, and he's got this, you know, weird schedule where he has days on and days off, where he's in clinic and not in clinic. And he was one of those first customers that I found who is like this kind of loyal fan of a product and built his outdoor kitchen with us. And, you know, we just kind of became buddies and you talk a lot. And I found like he was in these groups online and answering a lot of questions about our products. So I just said, hey, you know, you're already kind of doing this. How about we formalize it? I don't want you to do anything other than if people need help putting their plan together, help them do that. And then here's the commission schedule for it. And he said, yeah, sure. This sounds really fun. And it's primarily because it's a bit of a passion project for him too.
Right.
And he enjoys helping people and he likes solving problems and working on these things. And then he gets a little bit of insider access to the industry now because we're so well connected to all these grill manufacturers and other players in the space and kind of some of the social media influencers that we know now and stuff. And he kind of gets the behind the scenes access to that. So he's been a great addition to the team. And that was interesting for me because it was at a point that I was starting to worry, like we've got great revenue, we've got pretty good margins, but hiring somebody full time takes a big chunk out of things. It's a big commitment. And I think as well, it's a big responsibility. And that's something I really care a lot about. Like, I don't want to bring somebody on to something that's not stable or not going to work out and turn their life upside down. So,
well, and how did you balance this as a side hustle for you and not impacting your primary job? How did you balance that?
It's really easy, Matt. You just don't sleep. You've been there.
I get it. Last week I worked 17 hours one day. I get it. Yeah. I was there.
Yeah. And you know, that's kind of how I'm wired is that if I've got a problem, I can't rest until I've solved that problem. But it did become a bigger issue to the point this last year where I've said, I can't sustain this myself and a couple part-time people. And so last July, I'd actually decided I'm going to leave my job at Microsoft and I'm just going to do this full time. And there were a couple factors that kind of came up that I said, well, maybe I shouldn't. But one of those things that occurred to me was even if I was doing this full time, I still needed help. And so I decided we're going to try this. I'd been juggling so much that I could probably continue to do that while having somebody else full time that would allow me to still maintain the balance between working full time and working on Matchless and, you know, give this a little bit more runway. And if that worked out really well, then by the time that we needed to make another hire, you know, everything's just rolling to where it's funding itself and making it really easy to do that. So I had prior last year, like reconnected with an old friend from college who had a lot of really good relevant experience with what we were doing and was looking for that next move in his career. And we sat down, we had a decent conversation. And I think, you know, very similar to like when you hired me at Stackify back in the day when things were early, was able to say, here's what I can do today. I hope there's some good upside in the future. You know, here's some of the risks that you're going to take, but you know, here's what we could do together. And, you know, a little bit of a leap of faith for him. He had a family he has family and kids and all that. But we did that about 4 or 5 months ago and it's been phenomenal. I mean, hiring the right person at the right stage to, and then being able to hand them off the work that needs to be done to make yourself available for doing more important things has been just tremendous.
Yeah. Delegating is huge and it's a skill that everybody has to learn, especially as a business owner, right? Like constantly trying to figure out how to delegate more and more things to other people and trust them, which is hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that I've always really struggled with because, and you've seen it firsthand from me, you know, being able to hand something off because I know I'm going to do it faster or I'm going to do it better or whatever the reason is. At a certain point though, and it's similar to, you know, raising kids, you have to let them learn some lessons, right? So you give the proper amount of runway and you give a support system and, you know, hopefully they can figure out what to do and improve and all that. And I had to really commit myself to that process, but it's worked out fantastic.
So let me ask you this. Did your wife ever help with the business?
Sometimes. We aren't the best to work together. Like we've known that for a long time.
Some people it's not. Some people it is. I get it.
We have such distinctly different ways of accomplishing work and opinions on how that should be done. It's oil and water sometimes. But she does help out with a number of things. So we're going into a period of the year right now where we get busy with trade shows. And she's a tremendous help at those, helping get us organized, travel plans, reservations, logistics, ordering the company t-shirts, and then helping us work those booths. You know, you've done it at software development shows. We've been there where we've done like, you know, Microsoft Build and stuff like that. And you're standing there talking to people for 8 hours. And then it goes to like the reception after, and you're doing it for another 4 hours. And it's you know, a huge help to have people in the booth who know the product and can talk to the product. And what I found as well is when we go to consumer shows, having, I don't want this to sound sexist, but it's really true, having a woman in the booth, when you have a couple, a married couple come along and they're talking about this, and I've found it to be true almost all the time with my customers. Usually it's the husband who says, "Ooh, I want to build this outdoor kitchen. I want to put all my grills and stuff in." And the wife says, "But it needs to look nice, and I'm going to pick the colors."
Having
my wife there to be able to talk about that and to relate to, and the fact that she's a interior designer sort of person, she helps people pick out colors and kind of go through the decision-making process of how they should lay things out and all that. And she sees that a lot differently than I do. So she's a great asset to pull on to say, "I can't help you pick colors. I'm colorblind, but here's my wife, and she's really good at it and does it every day."
You have the perfect excuse. You have the perfect excuse to cop out of that.
I do.
Well, let me ask you this. So where are all the cabinets manufactured? Are they manufactured here in Missouri?
No, but they are manufactured in the U.S. So our manufacturing facility is in Northern Indiana. It's a really interesting community. So we mentioned earlier that they're primarily Amish, and take every preconception that you have and throw it out the window, because they're Amish, but they're using 3D rendering software. The manufacturing facility is world-class. I mean, we have a sheet fed laser cutter that is bigger than the first floor of my house. That's all automated. They take their 3D model, they load it into this basically giant printer, run sheets of aluminum through, laser cut it all, and then it goes out the other side, and panels are bent and hand welded. Enormous powder coat facility, and it's like an 80,000 square foot manufacturing facility, and it's in an area of the country that we've been a lot now, and it's really interesting. Almost all of the RV manufacturing in the country is done out there. And you go out, it's just endless lots full of RVs. And that's actually where my manufacturing partner got their start, was in just manufacturing OEM components for the RVs.
Okay. Makes sense. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. And then, you know, just through a series of things that would be their own story, similar to mine here today, they came across this need to build cabinetry.
But when you hear Amish people and people have different preconceived notions of that, there are also a lot of different kind of Amish people, right?
Yeah.
They're not all the same.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple kind of different kind of main Amish lines. And then there's also Mennonite, which is a little bit different, and a couple other factions like that. But what I've also found is so even within this small community, let's say it's like 30 square miles, there's a number of different churches, and the communities are all centered around their church. And now this is where it does get a little bit more traditional, because they all go by horse and buggy or bicycle. You know, they belong to a church that is within a couple miles of where they live, so that they have quick and easy access. And then that local church kind of sets their policy of how they live their lives. So of course, the biggest thing that people think is like no electricity. And that's somewhat true. I've seen some very interesting innovation and ways of applying the rules that have been set. So did you know that you can run a washing machine off of an 18-volt DeWalt battery?
Okay.
Yeah.
And that doesn't count as electricity.
Well, what it really comes down to, is I found the culture centers around a couple of concepts. One is not taking creature comforts for granted. And electricity would be one of those things.
Right.
And you know, they don't connect to the power grid because that's easy, right? But modifying things to work through electricity that they can produce, primarily through solar, is allowed because
okay.
that requires effort and work, and it's not something you can take for granted. It's a resource that you have to preserve a little bit because you have limited supply and some of those things. So it's been really interesting. And of course, they as a community will make some decisions. Like, so for the manufacturing facility, clearly we're doing welding and all this other stuff. It takes a lot of electricity. They actually have gone off the grid, and our entire plant is run off of solar and gas, which is just amazing when you consider the size of it. But there's no way we could build a product like this without having those tools. And that's really how it's viewed. It's a tool that allows them to build industry, which is now employing over 100 people in the area. So, you know, but they're making those decisions together as a community. And it's really interesting to see how that works.
I love that mentality, though, that they only want to like take benefit or advantage of the things from their work output, right? Like, they're not taking anything that's like given to them. They want to be responsible for like building it, and they reap what they sow kind of mentality, right? Is kind of how I'm hearing it. And that's kind of the opposite of a lot of other people. So I think that's actually really good.
Yeah, it is really
good. Everybody else wants the government handout, and they're like, no, if we want electricity, we're going to build it ourselves. Here we go.
We're going to build our electricity.
I like it.
But and I will say, like, I never thought I'd have so much fun as one night when we were out there. And so, of course, it's a family enterprise. And the person who I interface with on a daily basis is the oldest son of the gentleman who started this whole enterprise 20, 30 years ago. But we went over to their house for dinner, you know, kind of like multiple generations. And we had our kids, and we actually had my in-laws with me as well. And, you know, sit down in this big, big meal. And we always eat fantastic when we go out there. Like, they cook, and it's great stuff. And, you know, we thought, like, we had to like coach our kids a little bit. Like, okay, like, their kids, they don't know the TV shows, they don't know the movies, they don't know the video games, they don't know all this culture stuff. So, you know, it's going to be a little bit different. And like within 20 minutes, they're out there like playing basketball and just having the time of their lives with new friends. And then the kids like, hey, you want to go on a horse and buggy ride? And of course, my wife is like, I kind of want to go on a horse and buggy ride. I mean, if you had told me 3 years ago, I'd be traveling to Indiana every other month and sitting down and have dinner with my Amish friends, I would have said, what? What are you smoking, Matt? Like, no way. I don't even know anybody who's Amish.
for those that are not familiar with the Kansas City area, there are quite a few Amish communities in and around Kansas and Missouri and different places that I've interacted with myself over my lifetime. Like, I used to sell at flea markets, and there was a couple of flea markets we'd go to that were out more in rural areas, and like Amish or Mennonite people would come in, and we were selling weird stuff. Like, my dad would be selling like little buttons that had like Bart Simpson on it, or Homer Simpson, with like goofy sayings like "eat my shorts" and stuff like that. And so one of them would, of course, look at that and they're like, what is this? You know, like, because they had no cultural reference to it. So it was always interesting, you know. But you know, but definitely seem like some of the nicest people in the world.
They are. And you know, some of what we hear like is like partially true. And like there's a deal when they turn a certain age, they kind of leave and go out into the world, and they don't wear all the Amish clothes and all of that. And you know, some of them will. They'll get a car, they'll get a phone, they'll get a TV, and they'll do some of that until they decide to get married and join the church. And then they kind of go back to the Amish lifestyle. So like, I know some of them who they do get some of the pop culture reference. I know one Amish gentleman who like, he loved Family Guy. Like, in those couple of years he's out on his own, he just loved that show to pieces. And it, surprisingly enough, like the sense of humor that you get out of some of them is just absolutely not what I expected. So it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Well, do you have any other tips for us about starting your own side hustle and or trying to balance, you know, having a side hustle?
Oh man, I think a couple things. I did not expect this business to grow as much as it did so quickly, right? And I mean, I wish that was a problem that more side hustles or startups had. You know, sometimes it's just not meant to be. Sometimes it's a longer, more difficult path to get there. But I think ultimately, what's really important is knowing when the business is going at a different pace than what you expected it to, whether that's be faster or slower, right? Being able to have that kind of Patrick Mahomes sort of like quick decision making of like, this is in the moment, this is what we've got to do, either way is really important. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself failing in one of very many ways. And then like any other business, and you and I have discussed this before in just building technology products and businesses, is knowing when to say no is a really, really important thing. There's a lot, you know, early months. I mean, I had people coming to me all the time saying, oh, I see you have this, but I want this. And just having to say like, no, we aren't going to do anything custom. We're building a standard catalog, was really, really important. And it was tough to like turn some of that away, but the couple times that I did it, it ended up being so much headache and costing us so much money that I said, you know, never again. We're going to standardize. We'll make catalog changes when it's warranted. Like we get request A enough times, we're just going to make that standard. But anything that you do like that just gets in the way of the scale that you could be having organically. And it's a tough thing to do, but ultimately it should reward you well if you do that.
Well, I can definitely relate to that. And as an entrepreneur, you definitely get pulled in all sorts of different directions. And saying no is definitely one of the most viable things you can do. Well, yeah. I do want to remind everybody that if you need to hire some software developers to help grow your own startup, check us out at FullScale, fullscale.io. That's my company. And I use my background experience to help lead that company. And we've got 300 developers doing all kinds of stuff. Check us out, fullscale.io. Jason, I miss working with you. I mean, I think that's the hardest thing about, you know, business, right? Is a lot of times our best friends are people that we work with. So I definitely miss hanging out with you every day. And I don't know, one of these days, maybe we'll get to work together again. But
there's honestly nothing better than finding people that you work really well with and get along with, you know, even outside the work, and being able to do great things together.
Absolutely. Well, once again, this is Jason Taylor, and his company is Matchless Cabinets. You can check him out if you're looking for some custom outdoor cabinets. He's your guy, right? Matchlesscabinets.com.
We'd love to help you out. Matchless Cabinet, singular.com. Yep.
All right. You better get the S there. You better get the other domain.
Don't worry. We've got to redirect.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Jason.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me, Matt.
Take care.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by FullScale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.